Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, November 9th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we're about to get going with our two guests, but I just have to acknowledge what happened yesterday. We're not a political show, but the person elected president hasn't read a book in 20 years, but on this show, we read and enjoy and appreciate books, and we're going to, of course, continue to do that. We're broadcasting live at the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. More about that during the second half of the show. I'm your host for the hour, Nicole Nelson, here with Barbara DeMarco Barrett, who will pick up in the second half of the show. And each week, Barbara Marie or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, like I said, Barbara will be on with Jim Fusilli about the new collection, Crime Plus Music. But first up, novelist Sean Shiflett. Sean is the author of Hidden Places, which was included in Library Journal's 2004 Summer Highs, Fall Firsts list of most successful debuts. He's an associate professor of creative writing at Columbia College, Chicago. And his new novel is Hey Liberal, published by Academy Chicago, an imprint of Chicago Review Press. I'm so pleased to welcome him to the show. Hi there, Sean.
Hi, thanks for having me, Nicole, and my thanks to Stacey Berline, an excellent writer who told me about your show.
Yes, Stacey's a friend and a fellow author in the community, and I was glad that she hooked us up with your book because I really enjoyed it and I appreciated the story. And
thank you.
Let's start off by having you introduce your book to us and share that story with listeners.
You want me to read?
Oh, no. I mean, would you first introduce the book to us and give us a little bit of background on it since it comes from
a unique place? Oh, yes. Well, Hey Liberal is about a white boy going to a predominantly African-American high school, also heavily Hispanic, just after the Martin Luther King riots in Chicago. It's loosely based on experience, inspired by true experience, but it's definitely a novel and a fictional book.
Yeah, and I imagine the way you handled the material, and in the back of the book, you actually include a copy of the letter Martin Luther King Jr. sent to your father.
Right.
But the book is fiction, and did you ever consider writing it in memoir format instead?
People constantly told me I should do that to make money, but I'm drawn to fiction. I think fiction can get to the truth a little bit deeper, as paradoxical as that might be. And also, when you're in that experience, you miss so much because you're looking out for you're trying to stay safe. So by delving into fiction, you can bring in the stories you've heard that you believe from other people. You can take the point of view of other characters, and you can tell a much more full story than, say, in my experience anyways, than would have been in a memoir. I think a memoir would have been a pretty flat comparison for me to a book of fiction.
By choosing fiction, what were some of the main challenges you faced? For example, one of them, I imagine, was harming Simon, who I imagine is a version of yourself.
Yeah. Those were tough. Because those were, most of those were pretty autobiographical. So those were, scenes were really, get to them, you have to get enough distance from the pain of those experiences to make it work on the page. So that was difficult, but, I did finally think that I successfully achieved it.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how close to the fact those scenes were, especially because of...
Now, some of the other scenes, I take that back. I mean, there's definitely, he's around violence that are fictional scenes, but we might be talking about different things, and I got to be careful not to give the story away from anyone who wants to get the book. But the scenes that were, let me put it this way, the graphic violent scenes that were autobiographical were probably the last thing that fell into place for me, as far as making it work. And so That's a good thing. You know, writing is a therapy of sorts without being a therapy, and a psychologist friend of mine once says that's the best therapy, something that's therapeutic, which isn't officially a therapy. So there's some of that. You have to be careful, and this is really getting away from memoir, that you know, it's not just a confessional type book. You've got to find the story. So all the situation that I experienced in high school, it just gives you the situation, and that's just a foundation on which to build a story. So what's real, what's not, all of that goes into play. And, you know, to get a plotted, arcing story is something different, which you don't have to do necessarily in a memoir. So that was the challenge.
Mm. Well, Sean, would you read to us from the book?
Yeah, I'm going to just read from the beginning, and really what this is not, the characters aren't even there yet, it's just sort of, you know, a community voice, someone stepping in and saying and setting up the situation, because so, one of the things that's so hard with the 60s is just how much was going on, and I finally just said, you know, I'm just going to tell this like it's someone in the community talking, and it's very short, and it's the prologue, and it's called Chump Change. In Dexter High's modern wing, located on the north end of the block, a white boy named James Jeffrey came to study hall class, held in the auditorium due to student overcrowding, with a loaded .22 caliber rifle tucked under his trench coat. He whipped out his weapon, calmly took pot shots at students, and started a pell-mell stampede, with people ducking and dodging, sprinting, crab-crawling, or even slithering for the exits. Cops hit the scene in a dozen or so paddy wagons and squad cars. After a little give-up-or-we'll-blow-your-butt-away persuasion, Jeffrey surrendered without a fuss. Imagine, all those human targets at close range, and no one killed or wounded. The next day, Jeffrey was leading news in all of the Chicago newspapers and on TV newscasts. It turned out that he was the quiet loner type. Cops with a search warrant found neo-Nazi literature stashed under his bed at home. He told detectives down at the 18th Precinct that he flipped out because he was sick and tired of gangbangers threatening to jump him if he didn't hand over his lunch money. No one seems to remember exactly how much time he spent in a jail for juvenile offenders, but within a year of the shooting spree, the Jeffrey family had cleared out of the Northside Lincoln Park neighborhood, forwarding address unknown. Classes, most of which were in Dexter's connecting new and old buildings, so-called because the one in the middle of the block was built just after World War II, while its much older sibling, with four iconic columns, loomed like an ancient relic at the south end of the block, weren't even canceled on the day of Jeffrey's rampage, when daffodils and tulips and residential flower beds were already poking through the newly thawed earth. The way Dexter's principal, Dr. Donald Jerzak, explained it on the 10 o'clock Eyewitness News, he didn't want to risk further racial violence by breaking routine. Is that long enough?
I think that gives us a flavor. And,
okay.
It also makes clear the point that in the book there is this battle that happens, and it's between love and hate, or you know, forces of good and harm. And it, as I was reflecting on it this morning and thinking about what happened last night, it just, I wondered in constructing the story how you balanced those two, you know, not to go too dark and how
not to go too dark and not to just beat people over the head with the experience. Well, I did add a lot of, did you feel this, Nicole? I think there's a lot of scenes that are just funny. Some people hear that, and some people don't. So that particular opening is absolutely true. We did have this incident. This is in 1967. A kid did come to school. He did have his... It was so much like Columbine with the trench coat, the neo-Nazi stuff. People were bullying him. People might think I just stole that from Columbine, but that is exactly what happened. The reason why no one remembers it is because he didn't kill anyone. So when you don't have deaths, it just kind of fades a lot faster, the incident. But it did, you know, it was a precursor to what was going to come down at that school. What was your original question? I'm sorry, I'm rambling.
Oh, yeah, no, it was about...
Love and hate?
Yeah, basically.
Finally, you realize you can't just beat a reader over the head for an entire novel. And also, there were many funny things that happened. When you have different cultures who are suddenly forced together, whether it's in a high school, army, neighborhood, story happens. And within that story, there's some light moments and there's some heavy moments. And much of it, I think, and this is carried out through a lot of the dialogue more than anything, it's just funny, you know, the things that happen. So you have to keep your eye on the reader, keep your eye on your audience, and give them a break every once in a while, because that is actually more accurate to what happened. It's not, the human experience is full of a lot of different emotions, and if you can keep that going and throw the reader off balance, because the reader does not really want to be on balance all the time and go into a story the way they came out of it, you should be doing that, and changing your scene from scene to scene, and the mood, and what it's asking of the reader to bring into participation, into the reading experience, rather.
And you mentioned the use of dialogue to that end, and mm-hmm. I was very struck by the dialogue because it's so authentic and it is funny, and it has a just that rhythm of these different characters from different backgrounds. How mm-hmm. is it just something that comes easily to you, or how do you approach dialogue?
It is. As a kid, I guess I was a pretty good mimic. I didn't read a lot as a kid. I was a jock. I was really, and baseball is a theme throughout the book. I love to be read too. My sister was an avid reader, and she, one time we were both sick, and she read a Nancy Drew book to me from beginning to end when we were home. And I just loved. I guess you could call me a little lazy when it got to reading. I loved to be read too, but I didn't really start reading until after this experience. So I'm a very unlikely person to turn into a writer. And you can tell it in the prose, because there's this sort of physicality to the verbs, and you know, when people are moving, action is happening, I can pick up on that fairly easily. And that includes people talking. It's sort of a ventriloquy, I think, that happens, that does come relatively naturally to me.
And one of the characters is Officer Clark, and he was fascinating because, I mean, he's not a good man, but you don't stop there. You manage to round him out. And so can you talk about that process of rounding him out, or how you developed him?
Well, he was the one I worried about the most when it came to rounding out, because he is a blatant racist, and you do have to humanize your characters, no matter who they are. Otherwise, they're not believable. You know, they might they're kind of flat, two dimensional. And I did have to work at that. And oftentimes, I did by going into his past and telling him the story of his childhood, and also other times where he just, you know, he's a man who's going to keep the lid on the school at all costs. And I do have a grudging respect for that in some ways, even though he's causing problems as much as he's preventing them. So he was, you know, an opposite in many ways from me, and I found him fascinating to develop. I think the final image of him at the end of the book is what really brought it home for me, and I won't get into it, but he's certainly not satisfied with how the 60s turn out, even though you could say that side of the political spectrum won the battle in the short run, but it didn't really. You know, we were different after the 60s. We were just different for the better.
Being that the story, these characters, you know, there was a real person who inspired the Officer Clark character. Were you worried about the reaction of some of your friends or acquaintances?
Well, he's one of the more imaginary characters, actually. He's I did see some scenes that are in the book, but they were different cops. And then, like one cop I saw, you know, I was on a baseball team, and a lot of people would start, you know, there was this kind of racist game that would happen, where kids would, you know, say pig under their breath, or kind of pretend they were sneezing and say, pig. You know, once in a while, a cop would take you, what did you say? And that happened to me when I was on a baseball team and we were just all, you know, sitting in the dugout waiting for the game to start. And it happened to me in a gymnasium, which is in the book. And so I what if you take that just a little bit further? But both times it just seemed a little heavy-handed. You know, you are an adult. They are kids. And I kind of put a lot of different scenes I had put together. I did see someone save someone who was getting beat up on the playground. It was actually a moment where the cop did what he was supposed to do and single-handedly chase a mob away. So you put all these things together, and then there's things you know about. You know, we did have, my dad was a civil rights activist minister in the neighborhood. We would have cops who would drop in on us every once in a while. So from this, you amalgamate a character, and then there is something where they just get up and walk on their own. That's what Faulkner calls it, and that's what happened with Officer Clark. At a certain point, he just started to tell me what he was doing, and that's a wonderful moment, as much as the character did terrify me. As far as the writing experience is, it's wonderful. It's thrilling when characters do things like that. Lewis is another one who just got up and walked on his own. I had to write him backwards. I saw him in his last scene, and I could tell you the people who went into him, but he's basically another combination of a lot of people, including historical fact. And that was interesting. So I literally had to write him backwards, and you'll know why when you read the book and you see the last scene that he's in.
I'm talking to Sean Shiflett about his new novel, Hey Liberal. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Can you talk some more, Sean, about revising and so in developing Lewis? Like, how did, if you can weave that into that second draft discussion or how that
second happened. Draft? Geez, how about the 30th?
Oh, you know what I mean.
I rewrite. This book, I would never recommend this process to anyone. I wrote the first chapters when I was, 19, 20, and I'm 61 now. I'm going to be 62 next month. So this book was a ridiculously long and arduous process. I stopped it. I wrote another novel, came back to it. To me, this is my big book as far as the one I had to write. But as far as revision goes, thousands of pages went into this book. And it's not, when it came out, I said, boy, this isn't very long. Man, after all that work, look at this book. It doesn't even quite get to 300 pages. But thousands of pages went into it. Probably at least three novels were, you know, where I said, I'm done and couldn't sell it for good reason. It wasn't ready. And maybe a fourth of it survived from the first draft. So, because I think I was a raw talent coming as a jock, as I was to a totally different discipline. And again, I'm the last person who should have ended up a writer, but I did. I had to learn the skill, the technical skill that goes into telling a complicated story like this from multiple points of view. And that took time, and it also took some emotional distance. And I don't think I really achieved that until maybe 5-6 years ago. And that's when most of this book came together. Certainly structurally it came together. And then you have to write it, you know, on top of your full-time job teaching and that kind of thing and your family, and you're trying to balance all your balls as you know, go through life. So I spent, you could say this book was 30 years in the making. And you could say, but most of it came in the last 4 or 5 years too. It depends on how you look at it. But the process was sloppy. Sometimes the characters developed backwards. Other times scenes had to be thrown out, put back in, change the point of view. I have one scene where I tell it from Simon's, one of his good friends who's African-American, and I could not make that scene work no matter what I did. And finally, I just told it from Clyde's point of view. It's one of the places where I take a risk structurally. I think it's one of the finest chapters in the book. I always go to that. I read it out loud a lot. And who would know that? What writer would have thought that? Oh, just go to tell it from his best friend, one of his best friends.
I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about point of view, because we're mostly with Simon, but I think we get a taste of Officer Clark's perspective from his own point of view too. And
we do, yeah.
How much experimenting did you ever use third person along the way through the drafting, or?
Well, it is third person. You mean first person? Did I ever use first person as opposed to third person?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Let me ask you, Nicole, did you, in your memory, do you remember it as first person?
I do.
That's good. That's a real compliment, because what you want in third person is the physicality of a first person. Someone is still talking to me behind these characters. And that's one of the... I will remember that. You've made my day. So that's what you want, actually, in a book like this. It's very oral. It's a very oral story. You want people to walk away and go, wait a second. That wasn't first person? Really? You know, so that's exactly what I was after.
Well, you got me. I actually had to flip open my copy because I almost didn't believe you. But, yeah, you do set us in... Simon.
Even technically, what I just read, it sounds like it is someone talking to you, but there's never an I. Mm-hmm. There's never a we. The community voice, it's like the we is right under the surface with me, right there. It's present in the tone, but you don't get it. So you take someone like Flaubert writing Madame Bovary. It starts out, we noticed when Bovary comes into the room, and then the we just disappears. I just didn't even bother with the we, but the tone is still there.
So when you got to the point of circulating this with other people, have your parents, I don't know whether, mm-hmm. Have they read versions of the book?
Yes. Well, my mother just passed away last year, so, but she had read versions of it before that. I'm lucky, you know, my parents, they're very open to the story. People ask me, do you get along with your dad? How could your family send you to this experience? And I would not trade this experience. I tell this to people. You know, it was a year and a half. It wasn't. We had many experiences with people of color, starting from young childhood. Race has always been. As my dad was in civil rights, and they would, he'd have meetings in our living room in an all white Northwest Side neighborhood. So they were always trying to get me, and this is kind of manufactured, but manufactured is better than nothing, into an integrated situation. So things had changed so fast once Martin Luther King was shot that even people who went to high school in a similar situation just a couple of years before me, they don't know what I'm talking about. They had a pretty good time. So the anger that happened after King was shot was like a light switch went off in our culture. And I can't really blame my parents for not being able to keep up with that light switch. Plus, now that I'm a parent, I know almost nothing about what my kids are experiencing, and I have to interrogate them to find out anything. So you have Simon coming home in the book, and he's really not talking about anything that's happening, because his mission is to get along with people. That's what he's been told. Get along. And if he's not getting along, he feels like he's failing. And if he feels like he's failing, the last people he's going to tell are his parents. So this is something about, you know, the silence that happens with a teenager, which would happen anyways, even without this experience. You know, so I don't have any anger. And I'm very close to my dad. And I'm very proud of what he's done over his life. And he did really like the book. He did. So that's where we are with that.
Mm. I'm talking to Sean Shiflett about his new novel, Hey Liberal. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Sean, we're drawing down on our time, but
sure.
Before I let you go, I'd love to ask if you have any writing advice to share to help inspire the writer listeners.
I want to give some advice. That is, you know, I hear writers all the time who are very well known say when they come to Columbia and speak, and that is, it's not really the talent. You need talent to get to where you're going, but it's really the doggedness of sticking at it, putting in your time, writing, and that is what gets you to the published page after a while. I've seen people who were so talented they could just shake it out of their, metaphorically, okay, out of their shirt cuff. But when they get up against something that's difficult, they, because they were so talented, they don't plow through. They give up. They quit. So it's the person, not necessarily with the most talent, it's the person who just doesn't give up. And that's what gets a writer to where they want to go, finally. really, it's just doggedness.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. You know, it's I think we're all a little hungover from this election, and I appreciate you. Believe me, as a progressive, I'm feeling it. And we will continue on, Nicole. Things will go on, and we'll come together. We'll just keep presenting our case and hopefully get through the next 4 years. We will. We'll do this.
We will.
And stay tuned for more Writers on Writing. Jim Fusilli will be here in a minute, so please stay tuned. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco there, and I'm back to do the second half of the show. Writers on Writing is broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, and we're streaming on the web at KUCI.org as well. You can always visit my website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. And please go to iTunes as well and subscribe to Writers on Writing. And if you like the show, we would love to have you leave us a review. That will help others find the show more easily. In any case, in the first part of the show, Nicole spoke with writer Sean Shiflett. Next up is author and editor Jim Fusilli. Jim is the author of 8 novels. He also serves as the rock and pop music critic of the Wall Street Journal and is founder of RenewMusic.net, a music website for grown-ups. And he's editor of Crime Plus Music, an anthology of music-related noir short stories, and he's here to talk about that with us today. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on. As a writer of noir myself, with a story in USA Noir, I have a soft spot for the form, for the genre. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about how the anthology came about.
Well, I had written several short stories myself that were set in the world of music. And I was actually thinking of doing an anthology, adding some new ones to it. But I realized that every time I went to a writer's conference or met with writers socially, we would talk about music, and that they had a different point of view on what music meant to them. And so I just decided to open up the circle a little bit and invite 19 of my favorite writers to submit short stories, and they did. And that's how the anthology came to be.
Excellent. So once you had the stories come in, talk a little bit about how you worked with them, how much as an editor you took part in forming them. Did you have any ideas come in that you had to sort of help with structure, or, you know, ideas that maybe you helped develop, or how'd that go?
Well, the secret, I've edited a number of anthologies over the years, and the secret to doing a good one is to ask the best writers and the most professional writers. And that was the case here. I can't think of a single story that required any kind of serious rewriting. What we did was just trying to make it consistent throughout the book in terms of style. And we only had 2 caveats. I mean, we said to them that we didn't want any stories based on songs, you know, no interpretation or recasting of the lyrics of a song. And the other thing we wanted was no sort of stories about that some dead musician was found alive or that some lost recording was found somewhere. But other than that, they were free to do what they want. And we actually did get a very good mix of eras and types of music.
Interesting. So I'm curious if you have a favorite or a couple of favorites.
Well, it's so hard to say because but first of all, there are a lot of good ones. I mean, I don't find a clinker in the bunch. I'll just answer that question how I feel today. I love Peter Blauner's story about Frankie Lyman.
Mm-hmm.
I love Willie Valentin's story about those 2 old musicians who are getting sort of edged out from their band. I think Gary Phillips's story is very funny and very clever. In fact, there's a really good mix of humor and pathos and sort of both ends of the noir scale are explored pretty well in this anthology.
Speaking of Gary Phillips' story, he asked me to ask you to talk a little bit about it, because there's a reference to Shatterhawk, the Soul Shaker, and I hadn't been familiar with that cultural phenomenon. Could you talk about it, Shatterhawk, and his inclusion in the story?
Well, I think Gary wanted to take an extreme soul point of view of soul music, and that has something to do with ghosts and spirits and danger, and weave it into a story that had all those elements, but also humor. And I know Gary for a very long time, and I remember when I read the story, I had two conflicting thoughts, which was, yeah, I should have expected something really unusual from Gary. And simultaneously, I remember thinking, you know, I really don't know much about this. So in addition to entertaining me with good writing, he's educating me about a subculture I don't know anything about.
Interesting. Love to hear you read from any of Crime Plus music. Would you like to do that?
I'd love to. Is it vain to pick my own story?
No, not at all.
Okay. My story is set in the world of electronic dance music. And it's about a young boy who is tempted to give up his perception of what he wants his career to be, which is highly creative and innovative and not at all cookie cutter. And yet he's tempted to join the world of the electronic dance music scene, which your listeners may know is the most popular form of music today, generating about $8 billion in sales per year. Our character Bowie is flown to Malibu from the Upper Peninsula in the Midwest to participate, to actually play DJ at a house party. And before he plays DJ, he is met by the two people who are going to take over his career. One is called Ionic Strength, who is a fellow producer, and the other is called Rakesh Malik, who is the president of the electronic dance music company that wants to hire him. So we begin with Bowie at a party in Malibu.
Okay.
Bowie felt a hand on the small of his back, and when he turned, there was Ionic Strength, Malik, at his flank. "Here's your boy," Ion said with cheer. He wasn't the only man wearing sunglasses at night. Rakesh Malik's eyes sparkled when he smiled. "Hi, Bowie," he said warmly as they shook hands. "Thank you for coming." Malik was in his mid-40s with salt and pepper goatee, short, thick, and gleaming. He wore business apparel, gray and lavender. There was a faint trace of India in his accent as he spoke over the booming music. "I trust Ion has taken good care of you," Malik said. "He is," Bowie nodded. "But it's all a bit much." "It is all a bit much," Bowie agreed. He wasn't sure what he was projecting, but he roiled inside. "At least there is music," Malik said. Ionic Strength waited for the boy's reply. "Yes," thought the boy. 128 beats per minute, 4 beats per bar. Here comes the breakdown, right on time. Now the drop. Music by a prescription. "It's very Avicii," Bowie replied. "Late Avicii." Bowie knew Avicii had signed with a label before he turned 18. He topped out at 21. Malik knew Avicii hadn't yet turned 30 and was worth $50 million. Ion hit his frown. Was this kid from the North Pole probing? Did he just send Rakesh a message that he was ready to sign on the dotted line? Ionic Strength had told the boy he had told Malik he had it under control. EDM was ready for a new boy wonder. "Bowie Thomas, he slides right in," Ion had said. "He's the kid next door, the All-American. He's having fun, you're having fun. Porter Robinson, Flume, Bowie Thomas." A woman approached, a goddess, an African queen. She nestled into Malik as if she had reserved the spot. "Rakesh," she whined. Bowie couldn't tell if it was a request or a command. "I trust we will see you again soon," Malik said. "Thank you," Bowie replied, "for the invitation, thank you." As Malik was steered away, Ion said, "Let me ask you something, boing boing. Do you think you're ready?" Bowie said, "I can do what I do, so yes, I'll say yes." Ion said, "Bold. But you can only get so far by yourself." Bowie did not reply. He had knew what the game would be before he left Sault Ste. Marie, before he put on the Tiesto jacket, before he stood in a room full of mannequins.
Thank you so much. That was Jim Fusilli reading from Crime Plus Music, 20 Stories of Music-Themed Noir, published by Three Room Press. What came first, the music criticism or the fiction, and does one discipline inform the other for you?
I wanted to be a novelist for a very, very long time, and I could not get it right. It took me 13 years to write my first novel. Along the way, I had begun to establish a reputation as a journalist. For some reason, I had a pretty clear and strong voice as a critic from a fairly young age, probably because I grew up surrounded by music and had opinions about music from very early on. But the novels came very slow, and so did the short stories. And I think one of the reasons was that I didn't differentiate between them. You know, my column in the Wall Street Journal appears once a week, and I probably have the reader's attention for about 90 seconds. And I have to make a very strong point very early on in the story to retain their attention. And it's not a dialogue. I am expressing my opinion. I have an informed opinion. I welcome reader input via email or other forms of communication, but my column is basically my point of view. Of course, the novel is very different. The novel is a shared experience between author and reader, and I'm going to be with that reader for a long time. Sometimes it takes people several weeks to read a novel. And I need to have air and not be such an imposing figure, to let the reader and the characters establish a relationship. And it took me a long time to understand that they were really different, doing journalism and writing novels. Same toolbox, but applied very differently.
And you said a few minutes ago that you didn't differentiate between short stories and novels. And can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, in the beginning, I had as much difficulty as I was having writing novels. I just found short stories really impossible. I just couldn't manage the brevity. I didn't know how to write succinctly. I didn't know how to choose what to say and what not to say. And it became quite a challenge for me. Once I had my first novel published, I really did want to learn how to write short stories. I really found it a good way to stay fresh and a good way to learn a new discipline. And in time, I developed a competency in short story writing that has a positive effect on my novels. My Mob Sinatra novel, Narrow's Gate, is a big, giant epic, sweeping crime story involving the mob and the foundation of Las Vegas, etc. And it takes several generations in the pre-war and post-war years. But the two novels I wrote after that are really terse, short, very fast, fast-cutting, lots left out for the reader to interject herself or himself. And that kind of writing came from doing short stories, from learning where to step out of the way and how to provide only what's essential.
I like what you said. Novels need air. That's kind of an interesting way of thinking about it.
You know, and one of these anthologies I did, I edited a short story by Jeffrey Deaver. And when I first opened it, I read it very quickly and I thought to myself, this is a magnificent short story because it contains everything I didn't know, and he explains it to me. And everything I already knew, he doesn't explain to me. He's managed to figure out exactly what my needs are in the story as a reader. And I just thought that was really great. And it was the idea of leaving space and leaving air, even in a short story, for the reader. And as you say, it's especially important in a novel.
Well, you know, what I have always found interesting about noir is that noir works great as short stories. It works great in movies, but novels not so much. And I'm not sure why that is. Is it because it's so dark and readers don't want to stay with dark for that long that they need a victorious ending of some sort?
Well, I do think it is difficult to to sustain the mood and tone of a noir story throughout a 400-page novel, let's say, or 350-page novel, because it is relentlessly bleak. And those who can do it by sprinkling in some dark humor or some dark romance to change things up without taking away the darkness. It's very difficult to do. When my first four novels came out, people were referring to them as noir, and I didn't really think that was the case. I just thought, you know, they were stories about bad things that had happened to good people. And I was always compelled to bring in the light. I always wanted people to have hope and to have a way out. And inevitably, I would deliver some sort of ending that would lift people out of the darkness. So maybe that has something to do with it. Maybe writers just really find it difficult to be so relentlessly bleak and unhelpful to their own characters.
Mm, yeah. It's hard enough in a novel that ends well or ends happily to have things happen to your characters, right? I mean, you don't want that.
Yeah, you become invested in them. You know, you have a hierarchy of goodness and a hierarchy of evil. It's pretty easy to get rid of the evil characters, but when you have characters who are doing good things, conveying your good intentions as a writer, sometimes it can be cruel to just dismiss them.
Yeah, exactly. You are listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Jim Fusilli. His anthology, current anthology, is Crime Plus Music, 20 Stories of Music-Themed Noir, published by Three Room Press. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and if you just tuned in, it's a little bit late, but we will put this podcast up on the website along with the others within a week or so. Let's talk for a minute about the business of publishing an anthology. And I'm curious if you sold it with a proposal and how hard it is to sell an anthology.
Well, I was in an anthology edited by Lawrence Block, who I'm proud to say is a friend of mine and a mentor and somebody I looked up to when I was first becoming a writer back in the 90s, I guess, is when I first met Larry. And he edited an anthology for Three Rooms Press. And it went very well. I thought they promoted the book really well, and I thought the stories were great. Larry seemed very pleased with it. So I went to a party for this anthology that Larry did, and the publisher was there. And as I said, I had been thinking about doing one myself. But all of a sudden, I just blurted it out to him. I just said, would you be interested in an anthology of short stories hooked around music and crime? And he said yes. And it was really that simple. Now, I have to say that I belong to the Mystery Writers of America, which is about the most welcoming and pay-it-forward community that you could ever be involved in. I mean, mm-hmm. It's really just really warm and welcoming, and it's connected to the writers who were part of the organization back when it first started. History is heavy, and once you're in this organization, you're really treated beautifully. And so we are encouraged to stay in touch with each other and contact and talk. It's not a cabal by any means. It's a very large group of writers who know each other. But we seem to be always dialoguing about writing and markets and how to reach readers and how to best serve readers and what are readers looking for. So there was that aspect of it that once it was green-lighted, I think I asked 25 people to be in it and 19 said yes.
Hmm. Wow. Lucky man.
Well.
Or hardworking or both, right?
Well.
Well, we have a few minutes left. I wonder if you would offer any advice or words of wisdom for the fiction writers listening.
Well, my advice tends to be a little bit unorthodox. I'm 63 years old, and so I come from the pre-Amazon days and the pre-self-publishing days. So my advice may not be what writers want to hear, but I always advise people not to focus on publishing. I encourage them to focus on writing the books only they can write, to discover what is at the heart of their desire to be a writer. What is the story that they feel they must tell, that the life experiences that they've had have brought them to? You know, you can publish a bad book. That's not a problem anymore. You know, there are people who will publish the worst book possible if they think they can make a little bit of money on it. And you can publish it yourself if you want to, and it'll be on Amazon, and everybody out there will think it's legitimate. But if you want to write a book that you can be really proud of 25 years from now, you know, you really have to approach it as art, as a desire to express yourself, your inner life, in a story that readers will accept and share with you. If you do that, publication will happen. You know, you will find a way to be published, and you will be welcome to the community of published authors. But if you try to ram your way in with something that's subpar, just so you can go to your high school reunion and say, "Hey, I'm an author," that's going to come back and bite you in the long run. It really will.
I love that advice because, self-publishing has made it a bit too easy, I think. And it's always a question of where's the bar, right?
Right. You know, I actually just did self-publish a book called Catching Up, which is a guide to contemporary music for grown-ups. I wanted to have the experience of self-publishing. And since I saw this kind of like a glorified pamphlet that had a limited marketplace, you know, it's really for people 40 and older who feel disconnected from contemporary music. And I just thought, you know, a publisher's not going to invest heavily into this. So let me see what it's all about, self-publishing a book. And I can tell you that it is a lot of work. It's not as simple as it seems. And, you know, I've been blessed. I've had 8 novels and a book of nonfiction published by the, you know, great traditional publishers. And I can tell you, I never appreciated how much they do for an author until I tried to do it all myself. So for people who think, you know, they're going to write a book and get it self-published and slap it up on Amazon and it's going to be a bestseller and you're going to have checks coming in, that's highly, highly unlikely.
Not to mention all the marketing you have to do, right? That is not fun for a writer.
No, you're taken into a world that you don't know. And to get back to Crime Plus Music, you know, this is a really good publishing house, Three Rooms Press, fully integrated, both vertically and horizontally. All the services you need to get your book is provided by this publisher. And, you know, it was such a refreshment after trying to do it all by myself with Catching Up to be back into the world of traditional publishing that I sincerely doubt I'll ever self-publish a book again.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has been a great pleasure to talk with you, and thank you so much for Crime Plus Music.
Well, thank you, and thank you for a chance to talk to your listeners.
Oh, you're welcome. That was Jim Fusilli. His book is Crime Plus Music, 20 Stories of Music Themed Noir, and it's published by Three Room Press. The show will join the others up on the web within a week or so. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and it is so fitting to talk about noir today on the morning after a very dark night for a lot of us, at least half of us, right? Thank you for listening. Stay in the chair, get your writing done, and be well. We'll see you here next week.